artists are pretty fed up with Spotify these days. They pay absolutely nothing, but on our platform, artists could actually earn a living and really monetize their music through streaming.
TuneFM, what are you doing with it? What's the idea behind it?
Yeah, so we're sort of like a Web3 Spotify or a crypto jukebox, if you will. We're really trying to change the game and really upgrade the music business model. And that's all possible through the blockchain technology. We've created a token called Jam that actually can facilitate micropayments. For every second that the music gets played, the artist gets paid, we facilitate that transaction with Jam directly from the listener wallet to the artist wallet. Artists make over 100 times more than they would on Spotify.
Andrew Antar.
How's it going?
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you're in Nashville from Philadelphia, have a blockchain project called TuneFM. Matt
right.
was filling me in, but I don't know if you know that, you know, Matt and I are big fans of the blockchain and Bitcoin and Ethereum, actually a lot of different ones. And when he told me about this, I was like, that'd be a great interview. And so thanks for coming. Talk a little bit about TuneFM. What are you doing with it? What's the idea behind it? And where do you want it to go?
Yeah, so we're sort of like a Web3 Spotify or a crypto jukebox, if you will. We're really trying to change the game and really upgrade the music business model that's out there. It sort of changed the way the industry works. And that's all possible through the blockchain technology and through tokenization, crypto. And so what we've done is we've created a token called Jam that actually can facilitate micropayments. So our motto is when the music is played, the artist gets paid. So for every second that the music gets played, you know, the artist gets paid, and that we facilitate that transaction with Jam directly from the listener wallet to the artist wallet. And so on the streaming side alone, artists make over 100 times more than they would on Spotify. And artists are pretty fed up with Spotify these days. They pay absolutely nothing, you know, peanuts compared to, say, touring or anything, or compared to us. But on our platform, artists could actually earn a living and really monetize their music through streaming. And we've taken that a step further with the digital assets and also known as music NFTs. So essentially they can tokenize their music, attach experiences, VIP access, backstage passes, things like that, and really monetize their super fans. So that's a super under-monetized area where there's a lot of value to be unlocked.
Well, so how does Spotify pay out? Because I think most people don't understand how the artists are paid from Spotify per play, but it's really not even per play. How does it work with Spotify?
Yeah, so it's not really per play because they can't actually guarantee a per play amount because there's too many sort of moving parts. You've got basically their subscriber revenue, and then you've got their ad revenue, mostly subscriber revenue, and then that's sliced and diced up against like billions of streams. And so that's sort of problematic. So the labels sort of strike a deal where they get 70% of the revenue. They don't know what that revenue is going to be. They don't know how many streams there's going to be. But somehow it works out to like 0.004 cents per play. And then the artists typically get less than 10% of that. So you got that going to the rights holder, and then the artist gets a fraction of that. But on our platform, we actually pay directly to the artist, or rights holder for that matter, 1 cent per minute. So a 4-minute song would be 4 cents. So several orders of magnitude more, and that's where we get that 100x figure.
How has your company been growing? Like, how many users or listeners do you have right now?
Yeah, so we've been growing. We have over 100,000 users. We have over 10,000 artists. We have everyone from independent artists around the world to celebrity artists, so a lot of cool stuff.
So you have about 100,000 users. How do the artists get paid? So when someone comes to your site, do they like what's the revenue model?
Yeah, so even though we're a Web3 platform, a lot of traditional Web3, if you don't know what that is, it's like sort of crypto blockchain type of platform. it has a very complex onboarding process. You need to like download MetaMask Chrome extension. You need to buy Ethereum and send it over and do this and that. Log in with the wallet. All this kind of nonsense that most non-crypto native people don't truly get intuitively. So we've taken the tried and true Web2 model of just email and password, and we actually set up your non-custodial wallet. Non-custodial just means that you own your keys and your wallet and your crypto, and nobody can take that from you. Nobody has custody of those coins or assets. We actually encrypt your private key with your password. We have a private key recovery protocol if you need to reset your password. So it's not one of these things. If you lose your keys, lose your password, you lose your crypto. But we still have that security with multi-sig and with the non-custodial. Then we associate it to JAM, which is our token, automatically and airdrop you 1,000 JAM. So we're doing all the sophisticated stuff under the hood. So to the user, they just sign up, email, password, and click play. And boom, you're listening to music and you're automatically paying the artist for every stream. So we facilitate all the transactions seamlessly. You just use it like you're using Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Music, what have you. And all the transactions are happening automatically. So as an artist, you'll just have payments flying into your wallet all the time. Mm-hmm. As a listener, you'll have payments, you know, going out to all the different artists that you're listening to. But we also work the other way. So if an artist, we allow artists to promote their music. So if they want to expand their fan base to new listeners who haven't heard their music before, they can basically set up a budget behind a certain song that they're promoting. And then you have a sort of play to earn aspect where the listener can actually get paid to listen to promoted music if they're discovering new music. So the payments actually go both directions.
Wait, how does the listener get paid? How does that work?
So say like, you know, if you've ever run like Facebook ads or something, you put a certain budget, you have a ROAS, a sort of return on ad spend. The creative is basically, you know, whatever your ad is. In our case, it's like setting up a song as the ad. The song is the creative, where they'd say they put a budget of 1,000 JAM to promote this song. Only first-time listeners who have never listened to the song before can actually get paid for that first stream. So the same rate, the number of seconds they're listening.
Sure.
So there's a pool of promoted music that you can actually play to earn, PDE, as they say. And so you can, just for discovering that, for sort of going out on a limb and trying something new, that's worth more to the artist, that first stream, than it is to the listener sometimes. Sort of like the radio is when you get a, you know, song played on the radio. A lot of times labels and artists pay to actually have that promotion. And then if the listener loves a song, they stream it again or stream one of the other songs from the artist or stream the whole album. The moment they stream at least one or more, that artist is basically earning an ROI on that promotion budget. So if the music's any good, they'll have a high, you know, ROAS equivalent or ROI for their promotion. So we just want to give artists the tools to actually market on their own and expand their fan base and not necessarily need a label to do marketing for them. And then they can use their earnings in JAM and turn it around and expand their fan base and actually earn more in the end.
So, you know, with Spotify, what is their payment model?
So Spotify basically... you know, they take 70% of the revenue. They sort of divvy it up between the rights holders based on the streams.
What is someone that's listening to music?
Oh, okay, yeah.
When they subscribe,
it's like $9.99. Now it's actually $12.99 a month. But just for ease of, you know, say it's $9.99 a month, about $120 a year. Now it's actually more than that. It's, you know, changed. But $120 a year, on average... the average Spotify user streams about 12,000 minutes per year, which is around a little less than 20 hours per month, like 17 or 18. And so what that works out to is on our platform, if you were to stream the equivalent 12,000 minutes per year, that would also equal $120 because we're one penny per minute.
Yeah.
But if you consider the fact that you could actually get paid for a lot of those streams as a listener, we're offsetting those costs. And if you tend to listen to more music and discover more music, more experimental, you'll actually get paid even more. Or if you're streaming less, you'll pay less. So it's more of a pay-as-you-go model, mm-hmm. more a la carte, rather than a sort of all-you-can-eat buffet situation.
Interesting. So, you know, basically, if the person spends the average amount of time on your platform, it costs the same as Spotify, but the artist gets paid 100 times more.
Yeah.
Literally.
So it, yeah, exactly. It would cost the same slash less, because now that Spotify's increased to $12 a month, it's actually less. And if you stream any music that's paying out to you, it'll be less. So yes, we sort of wanted to set that equivalency, for the average listener. Now it's actually cheaper no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist gets paid 100 times more. Yeah.
So for artists, how do artists get on your platform?
They just sign up like anybody else.
The Spotify, I guess they have to sign up to Spotify too.
Well, they can't actually upload directly to Spotify.
I guess, so when we do our podcast on Spotify, do we upload it or how does that work? We upload it to Spotify. So I guess artists though, for
artists can't do that, but they go through a distributor. So there's like distributors like DistroKid or The Orchard, or there's a few other companies, InGrooves, this and that. They would upload to those companies.
Yep.
Those companies would then distribute to Spotify, Apple Music, all the above.
And so instead, they would go directly to you, upload their music.
Yeah. So Spotify tried to have this artist upload thing, and the labels sort of freaked out and pushed back, and they made them take it down. Because if they're allowing artists to upload to Spotify, that's sort of cannibalizing their revenue. And so they're not making any more revenue, and they would just be paying out less to the rights holders. So it's one of those things where with that business model, it doesn't actually work. With our business model, it does work because more people that upload, the more artists are to get paid. So it's, you know, depends who you're listening to. But yeah, anyone can just come to us sort of more like SoundCloud, where they can just create their profile, upload their music. The only difference is we actually pay the artists, versus SoundCloud doesn't pay anything to artists.
Mm-hmm. And so someone comes to your platform, they put their information in, you airdrop them, you said 1,000
jam.
And then do they say, okay, I'm going to put $20 on here and see how long it lasts me? Is that kind of then it runs out, or like what's the?
Yeah, I mean, they can easily reload it with credit card, put $20 on there. Sort of like you go to a casino, you buy some chips, go to the cashier, some cash, get some chips, play your games, win mm-hmm. or lose, and go cash out and leave. Same situation. It's like buying tokens to put into a jukebox type of thing. You can get in and out of them whenever you want. But yeah, I mean, you can just wait till you run out of tokens, and then we'll prompt you to buy more.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy them on an exchange. You can buy them on a DEX if you're into that, and send them in. So there's many ways to get in and out of the token.
How's the token been trading?
It's been good. We're on about 20 exchanges, all international exchanges. So MEXC is the biggest one.
You couldn't buy it in the United States?
Well, there are ways to do it. But technically, all these are international exchanges. It's up to them whether they'll let you in.
Mm-hmm.
Once we get a U.S. legal opinion letter, we'll do all the U.S. exchanges. But 90% of the crypto markets are international.
Yeah. So, but when someone is on your platform, you give them your token.
So you can buy it, yeah, with...
So they could put $1,000 onto your platform and just hold it there. And they could be worth more than...
Yeah. You can buy it with a credit card in the U.S.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. How's the security of this? Is it on like a ERC-20 platform or what?
So we've actually decided to go with the next generation blockchain that's far superior to any Ethereum-based protocol or even Ethereum variant type of thing. So it's not smart contract-based. We're built on a layer one called Hedera Hashgraph.
Hedera?
Yeah, Hedera.
Yep, okay.
And so Hedera's native asset is HBAR, if you're interested in that. But basically Hedera is by far the most secure, fastest, cheapest, best governed layer one protocol out there. We're sort of OG Hedera partners. We're one of the first partner, first token to be listed to launch on Hedera, the first Hedera token to be publicly listed.
And so you're technically a layer two then, or you're a layer two.
We're not really layer two. We're just the dApp. You could call layer two. We're just a dApp on top of layer one. Our tokens are actually layer one native tokens.
Okay.
So the smart contract is sort of sitting above the layer one. So an Ethereum ERC-20 token is sort of like, it's not a layer two, but it's sitting on a abstracted way from the Ethereum native token, right? So, but the way Hedera works is that the tokens that are minted on Hedera are the same code as the base layer token, HBAR. So our token, JAM, has the same high fidelity throughput, fee structure, everything, speed, everything, security that HBAR has. So it's basically the same thing as HBAR. Whereas if you're to look at the fees, throughput, speed, security of an ERC-20 versus Ethereum, it's actually slower and more expensive and all that. So it just sort of works a little bit differently. It's, you know, the fees are like a thousandth of a penny. So we can actually do micropayments. So that was kind of like a table stakes thing. Like with Ethereum, like transferring Ethereum or even USDT, these days it's costing me 20, 30, 40 bucks.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So like I use Tron for that. It's like a dollar or whatever, but still a dollar, like, or two, sometimes $3. Our fees to transfer a token are like a thousandth of a penny. So orders of magnitude cheaper. So with these micropayments, which is a new business model for media consumption in general, like the equivalent of like reading a newspaper and paying for every page or article that you're reading. Or, you know, it's basically a new way to pay for media where with credit cards, essentially, it has to be at least $5, $10 before it's worth it with the credit card fees of 30 cents plus 3%. Mm-hmm. With Bitcoin and Ethereum, like, it's got to be $50 or $100 transaction before it's worth even using those. You know, if you're going to pay $20, $30, sometimes more, sometimes over $50 for a transaction, you know, you better be transacting like $1,000 before it's even
worthwhile
to pay the crazy fees. But for us, you know, with a thousandth of a penny fee, we can actually do micropayments that are fractions of a cent, say half a penny, a few cents for a listen. And it's super fast, so we need super high throughput. So hundreds of thousands of transactions per second, which is also not possible with any Ethereum-based protocol. Those are like 10 to 15 transactions per second.
Yeah.
And you got Visa doing 70,000 transactions per second across the whole network, the whole world. So we needed a layer one that is better than fiat, better than Visa, lower fees than Visa, faster than Visa, all these things.
Yeah.
So it actually has to be better than fiat. Obviously, with Ethereum and all these other legacy blockchain things, there are advantages against fiat, you know, with the non-custodial thing and cross-border payments and sort of that type of stuff. But on the like actual fundamentals of speed and fees,
sure,
it's got to be better. And then you go a step further with Hedera. It's the most secure blockchain. So it's technically a distributed ledger technology, or DLT. But they're the only ones who have achieved full-blown asynchronous Byzantine fault tolerance.
So what is that?
That's a mouthful. In the blockchain world, everyone is trying to be like the most Byzantine. So it's a sliding scale of how secure it really is.
I see.
It's based on this thing called the Byzantine generals problem, where back when you had basically the Mongols invading like Byzantium and like, you know, the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire, which became like Constantinople and Istanbul, that city. now in Turkey. Imagine you have a city. You have four generals on each side. They decide they want to invade, or at least the main general wants to invade tomorrow at noon. So, but how can he get this message to all four generals each side of the city and guarantee that they all get the same message at the same time? So he sends out three messengers. You know, first messenger gets to the next general, says, tomorrow noon, all right, we're all good. The next one has to go all the way around. He gets killed on the way, right? That general on the other side of the city doesn't get any message. The other general on the other side gets intercepted by a spy, gets bribed, and basically is told to tell that general tomorrow at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. So then you have, instead of all four corners invading the city, you only have two. One doesn't even know about it. One is two hours too late. So that's the Byzantine general's problem. So if you think about it, think of these generals as nodes or computers, mm-hmm. right? When you have blockchain, the whole idea is this concept of consensus, right? So that would be the consensus of the generals. They all have consensus, right? And they have to send these messengers. You can't just like get on a walkie-talkie and say, hey, we're tomorrow at noon, right? He has to send these messengers. And same thing with the internet with these nodes. You can't just have this real-time, everyone knows the same thing at the same time because, I mean, you're limited by the speed of light, you know, speed of electricity, speed of the internet. A message still has to be sent from one node to another node halfway across the world. It might take a few seconds to propagate that message. Mm-hmm. But basically, you have to tell every single node or computer in the network the same thing. This is the balance of my wallet, and there's $10 in this wallet or 10 Bitcoin or 10 whatever. Mm-hmm. And not to get into the weeds on this, I'm almost finished. Basically, all of those nodes, all those wallets agreeing on the same ledger balance is what we call consensus. So that's how Byzantine is it. So with Bitcoin, you have these things called miner confirmations, mm-hmm. right? And so they say like, okay, well, maybe after 10 miner confirmations, that's good enough for us to be confident enough in this transaction. It's 10 different nodes basically agreed on this. They all have consensus. Mm-hmm. But that you're getting to 99.9% and closer to 100, you never actually get to 100. You never actually have mathematical Byzantine finality. Hmm. You have like this probabilistic consensus, 99.99999. With Hedera, you actually have mathematically provable 100% finality. And the closest you can, the highest level of Byzantine is asynchronous Byzantine fault tolerance. So BFT is everyone's trying to be Byzantine fault tolerant, but that's a degree. And asynchronous Byzantine fault tolerant is like the highest level. And basically what that means is that even though when you're sending a transaction out, like all these nodes are getting it at a different time, like, mm-hmm. you know, milliseconds after that one or nanoseconds after the next one, they all get the message at a different time. The way that they're able to all agree on the same message or the same balance at the same time stamp, mm-hmm. is that they basically vote. It's what they call it, virtual voting, but they vote on the agreeable timestamp. They're all on the same protocol using the same software. Mm. They basically agree to take the median timestamp amongst all the timestamps that all the nodes get. So the median timestamp, because it's not the average, because the average might not exist on a certain node. The median timestamp is the middle timestamp that that a node actually received. Mm-hmm. Then they all agree that we got this message or this transaction at this time. And then that's full finality. It's mathematically provable. Nobody else, no other blockchain is able to achieve that ABFT gold standard.
Interesting.
So long story short on that, it's just the most secure. And then the final thing I would say about Hedera is that it's the best governed. So with Bitcoin, you've got this sort of like oligarchy of miners. Mm-hmm. They kind of like run the show. And then with Ethereum, you have the like benevolent dictatorship of Vitalik, and he calls the shots. You know, he can do whatever, shut it down, mint whatever, you know, change the code. You know, it's up to him. And, you know, do you really trust like the, you know, Vitalik or whatever. Some people think he's an alien. I don't know. But
first time I saw him speak, I was like, that guy seems like an alien.
Yeah, exactly. But Hedera has actually created, while there are the founders, Mance and Lehman, Lehman Baer being the chief scientist, sort of math genius guy.
They're
all
of Hedera?
Of Hedera, yeah. Uh-huh. They actually taught mathematics at the Air Force Academy. They've sold multiple companies like Ping Identity for hundreds of millions of dollars. So they're mm-hmm. not even in this to make money. Like they've done pretty well. They've sort of taken a backseat to the governance. They running Swirl's Labs, which is like the creator of the technology, and they're building applications and things on Hedera. But they have this thing called the Governance Council. So it's sort of like a democratic republic type of situation where you've got 39 members. They all have term limits. They have voting rights. They can vote on different proposals.
That's a lot of members, though.
So the reason behind the number is that they want everybody to be able to meet in one room, and there's a tiebreaker vote. It's not an even number. So that's why. Now, you could do it with 19, sure. but those members are all big corporations, like everything from Google, IBM, LG, Boeing, some of the biggest banks in the world. They recently signed
Hedera.
Dell, yeah, and a bunch of other ones. They're all actual owners of the network. So the Governance Council members are true owners. They've all committed to build like real-world applications. They've invested a significant amount of sum of money into the network. And they also run nodes. So they're the permission node operators.
I mean, there's so many right now. I mean, you have Ethereum, Solana, Cardano.
Yeah.
I haven't, after the last bull run, I kind of stopped paying attention.
Yeah, and I can go through one by one why they're all inferior.
Yeah. Put an HBAR. I'm not familiar. HBAR coin. Let me see this sucker here. I have heard of it. I think somebody messaged
me to
buy
some. It's a top 30, you know, multi-billion dollar token.
Do the, where's the graph at? I want to see the price. Do 1 year. Let me see where we're at. Where's that over the year?
Well, it's doing pretty well, over 10 cents recently.
3.6 billion market cap. But you're saying it's a superior platform.
Yeah, so pull up those. That's the 39 governance, that thing on the right, that post. That's a graph. If you can pull up that graphic, it shows, I think it shows all the... there was a thumbnail there. That thumbnail is, I guess, some of the, they recently.
So you're saying that the CIA runs Hedera, basically? Yeah. Let's
just be real. Something like that. CIA runs Bitcoin, you know.
I don't know about that. I think the NSA probably, somebody from the NSA probably made it, but.
But these are all multinational.
Oh, I know. I'm looking at
Fortune 100.
So I mean,
centralized. Yeah,
that's good though. I mean, here's the thing. Blockchain is going centralized, right? I mean, of course it is. That's real world applications.
Yeah.
You have to. And so when I say the CIA is running this, it's a joke. But
yeah.
I mean, you got Google. You got IBM, you got all the CIA, you know, deep state Boeing type companies. But that's kind of a good thing. If you have a coin, if from an investment standpoint, you're looking at it being applied worldwide. Yeah. I have heard about it. I don't know why. Can you buy it on Coinbase?
Yeah.
Yeah, I should just buy it.
So the thing is, like, Hedera positioned itself as the enterprise grade blockchain network, right? Yeah. And we're not like, you know, into the whole like cypherpunk, like blow up the banks type, like counterculture kind of vibe when we're talking about just like what's essentially payments rails technology.
Sure.
It's like database. Like the way I see choosing a layer one to build on is sort of like choosing a database, like AWS versus Google versus mm-hmm. Oracle versus MongoDB. Anyone using your website doesn't know whether you're on AWS, nor do they care, honestly. Right. It's like a pure technological decision. What is the best security? What's the ease of use? What's all these things? So for us, it's like, what's the throughput or the speed? What's the security? What's the fee structure is the most important, like low fees, right? Those types of things.
Sure.
And so for us, like I couldn't find anything that could match up to that.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Have you looked at Casper?
I've looked at them all. Yeah. they all sort of fall short somewhere. There's a lot of, especially in software, you're always making trade-offs. So when they speed up, when they say these layer two solutions, like let's say Polygon, for example, it's basically taking Ethereum and putting it on steroids by speeding up, making it cheaper, but they sacrifice security.
Mm-hmm.
So you're pulling one lever and the other one's going the other direction.
Yeah.
And you can't do that with, so you need a fundamentally new technology. Like Hedera, it's not a traditional blockchain data structure. It's actually a DAG. It's a directed acyclical graph, which is just a different data structure. You don't have to really know what that is, but it just works differently. It's just fundamentally next generation, more efficient.
Sure.
It's think of it like instead of a single lane highway, it's having like a 10 lane on superhighway.
Yeah.
So you can just fit way more traffic.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way Hedera is architected from the beginning. And it's scalable. You could build another highway next to it.
What do you think of, you know, like the future of, you know, something like Ethereum? I like Ethereum a lot different than I look at Bitcoin, but what do you think of the future of you know, an application like Ethereum? And do you think it's eventually just going to get swallowed by these newer technologies?
Yeah, I mean, eventually, maybe. I mean, but like we still use gold, you know, we still transact in gold. Like there will always be a place for these legacy. We still have horse and buggy sometimes, you know. you know, even when we're 50 years into the electric car revolution and 80, 90% of the cars, you're still going to have internal combustion gas.
Yeah.
They'll still be there. It just won't be as relevant.
Yeah.
You know, at some point the 80-20 will flip.
Yeah. I mean, the great thing about, like I said, I don't look at Ethereum the same as Bitcoin. Bitcoin, major store of value, you know, it's, digital gold, only 21 million ever mind.
Yeah, and it's the oldest technology. It's the slowest, worst tech.
Yeah.
Like, you can't build on Bitcoin. Like, people are trying to build on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you wasting your time? This whole ordinals thing, I know, maybe angering some crypto bros, but it's just not realistic. Like, I want to build on the most robust, fastest, best, most secure thing,
mm-hmm.
tech. Like, the way I would choose any technology that I build, we're building on dozens and dozens of technologies that most people don't care about. For some reason with crypto, they care because it's a speculative investment too.
Yeah.
You know, because what's interesting about the crypto world when you have a token is that all of a sudden every startup is basically a public company.
It's wild,
so
right?
It's like, yeah, it's like imagine if you could actually buy into all these Silicon Valley startups. You can't.
Right.
You know, only once they've raised hundreds of millions of dollars and it's even hard on the secondary market. So what I think is really great about tokenization and having coins is that, like, and it's different from stocks, and I don't want to compare it to a security at all, because you don't have liquidation preferences, you don't have governance rights, you don't have rights to, you know, dividends or earnings or anything like you would with owning the stock in a company.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not talking about securities, but even a utility token or whatever, payment token or whatever the use case for the token is, it kind of has this weird effect of, like, that company is basically like a public company now. So we're kind of like a public company. Like, we have, you can call them investors, people who have bought into Jam. And in many great ways, they're the biggest supporters. People who have invested thousands of dollars, they're the most invested in the success of the project. Right? They are the biggest supporters. And a lot of times with startups, like, they're all about, like, find your 1,000 fans or your 100 super fans, right? And same thing with artists too. You can survive if you have 100 super fans or 1,000 super fans who are going to every show, buying all the merchandise, buying the experiences. And that's also something we should talk about, because we're monetizing that with NFTs. But startups can now have that, like, super bought in, like, almost ambassador level, like, really supportive investors in the project that can really take it to the next level. So,
yeah, I mean, it is in some ways not necessarily yours, but I'm saying just in general, I can see why it's looked at as a security, although it's not. I mean, but in certain ways, I mean, the idea, you know, some people, like, I don't invest in the stock market to be able to vote or to or have get a say. Dividends.
You're speculating, right?
Absolutely. So that's how I look at crypto, and
it's like buying wheat on the commodities exchange, or buying coffee or steel because you think the price is going to go up.
Of course.
So that's really what crypto is. They're mostly just commodities.
Absolutely, and it's fun because what I like about it. I mean, there's a lot of things I like about it, actually. But the idea that someone without a lot of money can do their research on a company and or a coin or a token and invest in that and potentially 20, 50, 100x, especially if they understand at least so far how the market cycle has gone. Like right now, we haven't even – well, maybe we'll look back and say we're in a bull market, but historically we're not yet. And so, you know, we're about to hit that halving event that has caused this trajectory of all of the coins to go up in the end. Well, not all of them, but you know what I'm saying? Like the vast majority of the market to get a ton of money into, a ton of dollars into. And it allows, because, you know, if you're just a regular person without a high net worth, you know, you can't, you're not even allowed to invest in projects unless you're an accredited investor, and which is complete bullshit.
It's sort of like democratizing angel investing.
Yes.
So there's this class of angel investors. They can put 10, 20, 50K into a project and basically earn 30, 50, 100X moon, you know? And now this is saying any regular Joe can do the same thing with the token. But also it's better than that because they can have instant liquidity. You can sell it on the exchange versus with a angel investment, you're locked in for 3 to 5 years and who knows whether you'll ever get your money out. So you need a way higher risk appetite. So this is making angel investing, fully liquid angel investing open to everyone. And that's what's so disruptive about crypto, essentially, at the end of the day. So you can do your own research and do all that stuff. But anything that brings a lot of institutional liquidity, like, for example, the Bitcoin ETFs, now you've got big BlackRock money coming directly into Bitcoin. And Bitcoin's sort of the feeder funnel where everything, all the liquidity percolates down to a lot of the other tokens. And that's why a lot of tokens are super correlated with Bitcoin. But the day that the Bitcoin ETFs were announced was the same day we announced our funding of the $20 million that we raised as well for our token. So that was just totally coincidence, but it's been super interesting to see how that's had an effect on the market and the different catalysts that will happen in the future.
So, but this thing, like TuneFM is going up as a coin, basically. You know, like, for instance, 2019, we were launching what's called United Cancer Centers. We were doing it in a security token offering. So we went to the SEC. We were going to be one of the first people to actually do a token offering.
Oh, wow.
That was SEC
like
approved.
Like a true security token.
Yes, we were doing a security token.
Yeah,
and
STO.
STO. And we were early to the party. We didn't succeed in raising the money. COVID happened. Fundraiser fell kind of flat on its face. But it was really a great idea. We were going to be the first institution to implement the new right to try legislation.
Oh, wow.
Cancer centers throughout the United States, and our team was amazing.
That's cool.
But we were early. If we would have done it in a if we were just like raising money in a regular format, not in a security token offering, we would have done it. I'm so glad we didn't now because we're a lot further along with things that are just as important, maybe more important to the world. And our initial idea will get done eventually, but it's going to be even better now that we didn't succeed on that security token offering. But I say all that because, you know, these platforms offer such an opportunity for the little person. You think about the United States. The United States is the last beacon of hope for entrepreneurship. You can't start a company pretty much anywhere else in the world and have the opportunity. You know, an immigrant comes to the United States, they're three times more likely to become a millionaire than someone's born here.
Yeah.
Why? Because they see the American dream. But crypto in many ways reminds me so much of that. Like you were talking about like the angel investing. It gives people that opportunity to, you know, really be a part of something early on. And we're still really, really early.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very much rooted in American fundamentals of entrepreneurial spirit and everything. But it's super important disruption because financial disruption because Silicon Valley is very much an insider's club.
Mm-hmm.
It's like for the bros, you know. And the they also bros. Invest in very like niche kind of things. Every fund has a thesis. So they only basically invest in, okay, we've decided to do B2B SaaS companies that are making an ARR of 1 to 3 million per year.
Right.
If you don't fit, if you're a square peg in a round hole, if you don't fit that perfectly yet, yeah. you're not getting a check from that company.
Yeah.
Most of them have a super narrow thesis. And even if they say they don't, like, they do because they have their check size and they have what they're looking for, you know. And it's really a tiny sliver of the possible businesses and business models that are out there. And if we actually wouldn't survive if it wasn't for crypto.
Right.
I mean, we had so much working against us. First off, we're a music company.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard, are you kidding me? We won't touch music with a 10-foot pole.
Right.
There are so many dead bodies out there in the music. Everyone and their grandmother wants to start a little music app, right? It's sure. almost like laughed out of the room.
Right.
Like, why would you waste your time on music? The industry is a disaster. Blah, blah, blah. It's super shiesty, shady, whatever. Sketchy characters. So there's music, right?
Right.
And then we're a marketplace. So they're like, oh, man, that must be hard. Like, you got the chicken and egg problem. Like, right. you got to have the supply side. You have the demand side. And like, a music marketplace? Like, okay, sayonara. Can't, uninvestable. That's just really hard road to go down. Huge mountain to climb. If you could pull it off, like, hats off to you. You know, this is the type of feedback we're getting. And then we're a consumer product, so we're not B2B. So the table stakes for consumers, like, you need millions of users for anyone to take you seriously, not a few hundred. With B2B, you have a few hundred paying customers, you're, like, golden. You know, you can raise VC dollars left and right. So consumer, music, marketplace, all these things are hard. And now you can add in Web3. Like, oh, well, yeah, we can't really touch Web3. It's too complicated. The accounting is a nightmare, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we are Web3 and we have our token, I don't need any VC. I've had 1,000 VC meetings. Now we can raise money on the token, not just from retail investors, but institutional people who buy the token. Private equity firms who are way more sophisticated than VCs, you know, they can look at the investment in a very like financialized way where say, okay, we get this discount, we have this way of buying the token, and we have this purchase program, this facility, and they can create these sophisticated financial products and investment strategies around tokens because they're liquid, right? So it's just way more their ball game, the way they've done investments in small and mid-cap public companies, they can take those structures and bring them to the token markets. And so there's a lot of big multi-billion dollar private equity firms that are really sort of like the new VCs of this era. But you can basically go at it with retail and bootstrap it with retail because like, hey, you know, in order to build a product, you still got to pay your engineers, you know? Mm-hmm. Like we have the best engineers in the world and like, they still need to eat and provide for their families. So it's like you can only get so much for free.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've raised a few angel checks here and there, you know, 20-50K at a time for several years before we, like, really released the token and started financing the company that way. And our first angel investor is Andy Hertzfeld, who co-created the Macintosh, which is pretty cool.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we've had a lot of great people who believed in my vision and sort of looked past, you know, the doubters. And we've had some, you know, institutional stuff, but really this company didn't really take off until we decided to go full-blown Web3, have our own token.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, we wouldn't be able to do what we're able to do now.
That's awesome. Sure. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, like, when did you start working on this project?
So we decided to do the sort of Web3 music streaming thing around 2019. That's when we started working on like the platform as it stands today.
And how did the idea come about? Like, so were you like having a beer with friends? Were you like just looking at the industry? What brought it up?
I mean, the story goes well before that. So me and my brother have been working on a music tech thing for many years before that. And this all started So first off, I'm a classically trained violinist. So okay. Me and my brother are both musicians. We're both violinists. I won a bunch of competitions when I was younger, toured the world with some orchestras. So I've always sort of been in the music space, come into contact with a lot of artists and musicians and understanding the plight of the starving musician and stuff like that. My other brother's also a singer-songwriter, guitar, piano, all the above. And in many ways, I wanted to create a platform for them, like the artists you can't monetize. Because there's something wrong with the fact that, you know, you've got these YouTubers making tons of money. You've got Instagram models and influencers that make one post and make 30K, 50K. Sure. So easy to monetize all these other forms of music, other forms of media. But music is the most important form of media, in my opinion, because it actually has a very important emotional component to it and really has a major impact on the brain. And the way, you know, music can put you in a certain mood or make you feel better or whatever. And musicians and artists, it takes a tremendous amount of skill and work over a lifetime to do that versus like just shooting a video or shooting a photo on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
This is like woefully under monetized compared to how super monetized everything else is.
Sure.
Like, something's wrong with that. Why is that? And it's really an artifact of like the way the industry has worked. For years, and it's sort of been keeping a damper and stunting the growth and monetization of music. And music monetization has always been influenced by the technology and distribution of that underlying media. And so I always felt that there is a new, if we leverage the new payments technology, the new distribution technology, you know, with streaming for the distribution, payments, crypto for the payments, we can actually usher in a new era of monetization and financialization of the music industry and really change the business model of the music industry at large. And so this started, you know, going back when I went to Brown and I started this thing called Musicians at Brown with a few friends. And because everyone I was meeting was like a sort of undercover virtuoso musician, you know, become friends with someone and like a week later be like, oh yeah, I'm like one of the world's best young piano players or whatever.
Yeah.
Or like I'd like kill it on the trumpet or whatever. And we'd jam all the time, at jam sessions all the time. I was always playing music. I was always bringing my violin everywhere, an electric violin.
Nice.
Playing bluegrass, jazz, folk, indie rock, everything. I even joined a klezmer band, get to my Jewish roots, you know.
Nice.
Do all that fun stuff. Old time string band, bluegrass, all this kind of cool stuff. Love that stuff. I love improv and all these things. So I was really expanding my horizons beyond classical. Through that experience, I was like, you know, I feel like everyone here is a musician. And I read a statistic once that 80% of adults identify as a musician, even an amateur musician.
Really?
Most people, oh, they pick up the guitar at some point.
That's cool.
Like, yeah, play the bass, whatever.
Sing in the shower.
Yeah, it's like, it's just like a fact of life. Like, and especially at like one of these types of institutions, you know, like Brown, where you have like a lot of like high level people who have achieved a lot, like you tend to have some like very extraordinary, you know, talent on,
sure,
in the music space, but like it's kind of just like it comes with the territory. And so I wanted to create a directory basically for all these musicians to find each other. So that's where Musicians at Brown came out. At first it was just a Google form, fill it out, and then when we thank you for your answers, I actually linked a public link to the answer spreadsheet, which is just a Google sheet that has everyone's answers that they filled in. So it was this massive spreadsheet with literally hundreds and hundreds of entries. And each entry, they're answering like 10, 20 questions. Like, you know, what instrument do you play? What genres do you play? Are you looking to join a band? Are you looking to start a band? Are you willing to be part of this kind of project? Or so you would have musicals, for example, that would need a pit orchestra. So they would need a drummer. They would need a, you know, some string players. They would need some brass or whatever it was. You'd have people who are, they're trying to form a band and they need a drummer. They need a bassist. They want a saxophone player. You've got jazz jams. You got funk jams. You got all these music groups. So I think this would just be super useful to have like a directory of all the musicians on campus.
Mm-hmm.
So I created that little form, took me like 20, 30 minutes. And then we had this thing where you could post it where there's like a digest that the whole, every Brown student would get an email with like stuff that students would post, like gigs or whatever it was, announcements, like student group announcements. So just put it out there. And overnight it blew up. Like literally hundreds of people signed up, ended up being thousands. And out of 6,000 students on campus, I think we had at least 4,000 had filled out this form.
That's cool.
So there goes the 80% thing. And the great thing about Google Docs, because I didn't actually build anything, was that you have this chat feature on the right, and you could see who's online, and it shows you live in real time people using this form.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a shared document, right? So you always had 30, 40, 50 people having this form open, clicking around, and all these colorful boxes are jumping around. Things lighten up like a Christmas tree.
That's cool.
People are using the chat, talking about this. I need this. I need that. It's this very lively thing. And I was like, wow, there's really something here. And that sort of planted the seed for this idea of like, what if I were to build a music social network type thing? And I was getting into tech. I was getting into startups. I started the first startup incubator at Brown. So the first sort of Y Combinator style startup accelerator. I was able to negotiate to get the first fund provisioned from this thing called the Social Innovation Initiative. Somebody had donated anonymously like 100K and they didn't know what to do with it. I said, hey, I know what to do with it. You know, why don't we give grants out to startups and like actually have a formalized thing? Because Stanford had their StartX program, Harvard had their Crimson Labs, and Princeton had their Tiger Labs. And I wanted to create Brown Venture Labs, now called B Labs. Still there. Now they have a $20 million building, and now they pitch Brown as like a school for entrepreneurship.
Oh, that's awesome.
When I went there, like entrepreneurship was kind of a dirty word. Like everyone's going to finance and consulting and banking and all this kind of stuff. But yeah. I was like, you know, that was, I went after 2008. So when the economy kind of bottomed out, entrepreneurship and startups was kind of the new thing. And Facebook was starting up. The Facebook movie came out. And so that was sort of the vibe, was like, go out on your own, go out west, go try and make it big in Silicon Valley. So I started the first accelerator. I also wanted to go through the accelerator myself with this idea. I was like, I'm going to go through with this music network idea, see what happens. So that was like the first 5K. Started building, like got a bunch of my friends who are engineers and computer science department. So my fraternity brothers, and I was like, hey guys, free pizza and beer every weekend. I get a few pizzas, case of beer, come work on this cool music project. We're going to hack this music network together. It's basically like musicians at Brown, but for everybody. They're like, sweet. Like, and that's how it all started. Like, started hacking every weekend. Then they work on it during the week. And then once the school was over and the program was over, the accelerator thing, I was like, well, I want to keep this going. So I moved out to Silicon Valley, rented a house in South San Francisco, kind of did the whole like Facebook mansion type experience for the summer, brought some of our top engineers who wanted to work with us for the summer, who you know, could have gone to work at Facebook and Google and all these places, but wanted to do the startup thing. And gave him a little tiny stipend, and we kept working on it. And then
what year was this? This is that you did this.
This is like 2012, 2013.
Okay,
yeah. And then you know, I met up with Andy Hertzfeld in Palo Alto, and he showed tell me all about Steve Jobs and all this kind of thing.
That's
it was
cool.
Really cool. And he put the first like 30K in, you know, and we're like, oh wow, like. We actually raised some money. Like, it's a real thing.
Yeah.
Kept it going. Then I decided a year or two later to move to Austin, Texas. Met some people there who really love what we're doing and backed us with like 250K.
Mm-hmm.
So we're like, okay, we'll keep it going, keep it going. We built it up. But then we kind of ran into the problems with fiat, like the credit card problems, like $5 minimum, trying to do downloads and split up the fees amongst all these people. And things kind of stagnated a little bit, to be honest. And we're like, well, where are we going to take this, right? Built this cool network, cool community, cool tech. We have really great tech. But like something is not quite right with the business model. Like the financial component, basically fiat was holding us back. And that's when I had the idea to sort of pivot into the crypto world. Then 2017 happened, and I've been mining Bitcoin since like 2010.
Oh, nice.
So unfortunately don't have that hard drive.
I want to hear about that.
So, yeah. Yeah, so I heard about it in 2010, and my college roommate had a gaming computer. So we're like, oh, and that's when you could still mine Bitcoin on a gaming computer. We started mining Bitcoin. I think we mined like a few hundred or a few thousand Bitcoin.
Oh, man.
At that point, it was totally worthless. It was just a joke, and we forgot about it. And then the hard drive just bricked one day and couldn't get it.
Oh, man.
Crazy stuff. But so I've always been having crypto in the back of my mind. Oh, why don't we accept Bitcoin on you know, our music site? At the time, it was called Hero FM. And basically, but I knew that because it was super slow, it would take 15, 20 minutes to do a transaction, and the fees were $15, $20, $30. I was like, well, this is obviously never going to work until it's like way better than credit cards. Mm-hmm. It's not even an option. So then once I heard about Hedera Hashgraph, which is around 2017, at the time, it was just Hashgraph technology. It hadn't even been launched as a public ledger called Hedera. I got a hold of the white paper, sort of tore that up, got a hold of some of the original founders and chief architects and engineers, and I said, I want to understand this thing all the way down to the nuts and bolts. Mm-hmm. Spent several hours on the phone, like, digging into it, asking all the questions. How is the virtual voting? How does the gossip protocol work? How does the asynchronous Byzantine fault tolerance? Some of the stuff I was explaining earlier, I really got full understanding of it. I want to understand this part of the white paper or whatever. And then when it sort of dawned on me, okay, this is actually what I've always been looking for. This is the technology that will enable us to do streaming royalty micropayments. True seamless payments, fractions of a penny, anywhere in the world, instantly, quickly, super low fees, super secure, the whole bit. And then I was like, well, guys, when are you launching like a public network, like Ethereum or whatever, so I can actually build on this thing? They're like, give us a few months, like, and we'll invite you to the launch. So I went to the launch in New York. It was this whole big thing, big production. They announced their initial partners. They're talking about music as a key use case, music streaming, getting paid. And I was like, that's us, guys. So we partnered within the first week of Hedera launching. We're sort of partners, flagship OG partners. We're the first dApp to launch. Nice. When the token service came out, we're the first token to launch, first to be publicly listed. So we've been flying the Hedera flag, you know, since the very beginning. And so we're Hedera first, Hedera native, Hedera all day. But yeah, I mean, that's what's cool about it. And we have to be on Hedera, and there's no other choice that we have because it's the only tech that can support our use case. And I'm super happy that we are, because nobody's come even close to being able to match what they've been able to put together. So yeah, we're really excited about it. And, you know, once we... Then it was a few years, you know, since 2017, 2018, of just figuring out what we're going to do with the business model. And then 2019, we started building TuneFM proper on Hedera. Mm-hmm. So that's when TuneFM really started. But it's gone through many ideas and iterations. I've been thinking about music and tech and building marketplaces, communities. And even my brother, who were partners, he was at Penn, and he was recording at Penn Studios, producing a lot of music, and he wanted to create a marketplace where you could sell tracks, like sell beats, just independently, any open marketplace for music. And it was funny because we coincidentally decided to start a music tech company completely independently. And then when we were together for Thanksgiving, I was telling my dad, I was like, hey, I'm starting this music tech thing. And he's like, oh, Brian started a music tech thing. I'm like, no, you're confusing it. I'm the one doing the music tech thing. And he's like, no, actually, he was talking to me yesterday about this. You should probably talk to him about it. And we're like both doing a music tech thing, but completely different angle, different idea. Yeah. I was more musician, social network. He was more open marketplace thing. And they're like, you know what? Why don't we combine these ideas, put them together, create a music social network marketplace, the whole bit, and it's way bigger idea, way more powerful. And then when we got the crypto Web3 sort of put into that for the financial economics component to create this whole music economy. And then it became a really big idea. And so that's the vision that we're going after, is creating a whole global music economy. We have our digital asset marketplace where everything is bought, sold, and traded in Jam. So all the exclusive experiences, whether backstage passes or meet and greets or cool things you can buy from artists, as well as the music streaming, everything's in Jam. So we see this streaming as sort of the main commodity, the way you have energy, electricity in the regular economy. And there's a certain price for that commodity. And then you have all the digital assets or all the different things you can buy in the normal economy in dollars are all priced differently and trade differently. Some are fixed price, some are auction, you know, to price, to find the price discovery. And so that's where we're creating this whole global music economy, where Jam is the global reserve currency for music. And essentially, you know, music's a universal language, and we need this global reserve currency for music, where anyone can off and on ramp to their local currency, whether they're using pounds or euros or dollars or Korean dollars or whatever they have, you know. And that's really kind of the overall vision for what we're doing.
How do they off ramp their money from Jam?
So we have several fiat on ramp and off ramp partners. Think of it like payment processors. When you try and buy something, do you want to use Apple Pay? Do you want to use Google Pay? Do you want to use Amazon Pay? Do you want to use Stripe? Do you want to use this? Very similar in crypto. You know, we have a partner called Banxa. We have a partner called C14. There's a few others that we're onboarding. There's DEXs. There's exchanges. There's many ways to get in and out.
Sure.
You can send it in and out. It's, you know, all decentralized and everything. But, for example, Banxa, you can buy with a credit card. You can sell, put it up back on your debit card, bank account. You can get in and out of the token into any local currency, Australian dollars, Brazilian dollars, euros, pounds. Doesn't matter. We're so dollar-centric, we think the whole world operates in dollars, and it actually doesn't.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. You know, getting money into a lot of the coins can be difficult sometimes. I mean, I understand yours, you can just do a credit card and then purchase the, you know, purchase the music from there. But it's not always that easy. And
there's trouble, and it is a friction point, and we're not in the business of being a, you know, money transfer, MTL type money service business.
Sure.
We do have an MSB license. It's pretty impossible to get MTL licenses in every
state.
What's
MSB?
Money service business.
Oh, I see.
Because you're using tokens for things. But MTL money transfer license, not to get into the weeds on the regulatory side, which I'm also working on, it's basically to be a fiat on and off ramp or an exchange in the US, you need these MTL licenses. And they're extremely difficult and extremely expensive and very costly and time consuming. It's one of these things that it shouldn't be that way, but it's just a nightmare. So we have to use partners for that.
Sure.
And we have seamless integration with API, and it's all on our website and it's embedded in our site. So you never have to leave and all that stuff. And we make it easy. We have to KYC, and we do KYC sharing. That's basically authenticating who you are. But even so, once you get through all that and you plug in your credit and you buy crypto, then your bank says, oh, well, we don't allow crypto purchases. We hate crypto. And the first 5-10 times I tried to buy Bitcoin on Coinbase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America is like, no go, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then once in a while, some random credit card will work, you know, and some exchange will work and another one won't. So that's kind of the case across the whole crypto space. It kind of sucks. It's hard to get money in. But once you find a way, and if you really want to, you'll find a way. And I think I found that C14 is actually great.
What is C14?
It's just another fiat on-ramp and off-ramp. So MoonPay is an example of an on- and off-ramp. It's sort of an embeddable widget where you can buy Bitcoin, buy Ethereum, buy any one of these HBAR, any one of these tokens.
Nice.
But we need to find on-ramps that will support Jam. So it's kind of complicated. Like, they have to source liquidity from an exchange.
Yep.
So they take the credit card payment. Then they have to buy Jam with that. And so, like, getting the right partners. So getting the fiat on-ramp and off-ramp partners, off-ramping is even harder than on-ramping. It's always easy to take money, but then to sell the jam and then send the money to a bank account, very difficult stuff from a financial standpoint. Sure. But we want to make it seamless for the customer. And we have these two partners now. We have another one called like Swipe Lux coming in. And, you know, there's half a dozen other partners. Like MoonPay is a big one, but they won't work with your token unless you're on Binance. And so we'll be on Binance pretty soon. But, you know, it's like got to walk before you can run type of thing. And we're on tier one exchanges like MEXC and Bitmart and Whitebit. And these are all solid exchanges, top 10 exchanges, top 15. But there's a couple more on our sites, you know, OKX, KuCoin, HTX, Binance, a few others.
How do you get on Coinbase?
Coinbase, yeah, of course. So it's funny, Coinbase is actually a small exchange compared to like Binance.
Is
it? I mean, there's a few US exchanges. There's Binance US, and there's Coinbase, there's Gemini, there's Kraken. Those are your sort of mainstay US exchanges. We're not yet on the U.S. exchanges, but we will be hopefully this year. That's a regulatory question where, you know, we've been advised that it's best to stay away until we have certain legal documents.
Sure.
Dots, some I's, cross.
Yeah, Ginsburg's a terrorist, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you've got that.
You don't want to say that, but I'm saying, like, I'm just thinking.
Yeah, that legislation. But I'm working on the legislation front to have I put together a whole policy brief and a proposal for a comprehensive federal regulatory framework.
Okay.
In a nutshell, basically it says like, look, A, it's got to be federal. Can't be a state-based approach. You know, it's great that we have these state-based sort of laboratories for crypto regulation. But we need to get from zero to one. We need regulatory clarity, right? Having zero regulation means that there are no rules to follow. So we don't know what's going to be legal and what's not legal. So we're always operating this gray area of like, oh, maybe it'll be like this, so be more like this, or maybe it'll be like that, so less like that. But we need to know, like, this is what's the law, so we can follow it. It's one of these weird situations where more regulation is actually good for business. So that's why it's super bipartisan, which is nice. So there's this Lummis Gillibrand bill that's going through. It's bipartisan, and I'm helping work craft that legislation as well with some other Senate offices and congressmen and different things. So I'm working on the Hill a little bit to help put this legislation together. And so it's got to be comprehensive. It's got to be federal. It's got to be comprehensive. So it can't just be about exchanges. It can't just be for stable coins. It can't just be about Bitcoin. It's got to cover all the bases. You've got to have token issuers, you got to have traders, you got to have DAOs, you got to have dApps, you got to have smart contracts, all these things that make up the crypto world. And it can't be this dogfight between the SEC and CFTC turf war. The CFTC, yes, it would be great if they regulated everything as a commodity, but not everything's a commodity.
Sure.
And they don't want anything to do with it. And we don't, the SEC can't do everything because not everything's security either. So I'm proposing to have this sort of middle of the ground, new agency, super lean, called the Digital Asset Commission, which basically would regulate, be the sort of regulatory body for it with subject matter experts, people actually understand the underlying tech.
No one care.
Yeah. And so they don't really care about it. And yes, if you have a pure security, delegate that to SEC. If you have a pure commodity, delegate that to CFTC, but they would be the ones making that determination. The reality is most of these assets are hybrid, somewhere in between. They have some security aspects, some commodity aspects, maybe completely different, like wild animal. And some of them, they change from one to the next and back. So that's why you sort of need a new regulatory framework.
Yeah, that makes sense.
To actually get there.
Well, much rather have like a digital asset, what do you call it, digital asset?
Commission.
Commission. Sort
of like Securities and Exchange Commission.
SEC. You know, I mean, it's just, it seems like Ginsburg, I don't know personally, I'm just reading articles and watching interviews, but.
Gary Gensler.
Yeah, Gary Gensler. Yeah, well, Ginsburg. What was that? Gensler, what did I say? Gary Ginsburg?
Not Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yeah, it's Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Gary Gensler.
Gary Gensler.
And Warren, Elizabeth Warren, also trying to kill crypto.
Yeah, it's been wild to watch. And it's unfortunate because, you know, I was watching, Jelly Roll is one of my buddies, and he was testifying in the Senate, and it was, oh, what is her name? We actually just said it. Elizabeth Warren was, you know, like interviewing him, and she brought up the whole crypto thing and how Bitcoin's used for nefarious things. It's like, well, yeah, Bitcoin, I'm sure it's used for some bad things, but what about the U.S. dollar? I mean, the U.S. dollar is
such a nonsense, like, way to characterize crypto, because honestly, like, the numbers for cash are as high as 80% of cash is used for illicit purposes.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy. Wow. But with crypto, it's like 0.01% are used for illicit purposes, because crypto is the most trackable thing there is. Yeah, that's what public.
They, you know, but the average person doesn't know that. So when they see Elizabeth Warren saying, oh, it's so hard to track, it's like, no, there's a whole blockchain. You can just go on there and look and see what the transaction was. You see what the hash code was. It's like,
yeah. Yeah. It's crazy because, like, you know, I mean, there's no reason to even use cash most of the time. People just, you know, say they're buying drugs or whatever. Like, illicit is like the only use case. But, like, with crypto, people use it for business. Like, because I can't, you know, send a wire. Like, I'm sending like dozens and dozens of payments a day, receiving, sending. I can't deal with the wires and the banks for this, or the credit cards and the fees. Like,
right.
I use crypto on a daily basis to run the business, right? And it's way better than fiat on just like having to deal with going to the bank or calling the bank and deal with wires, like, compared to what I do. It's like, it's crazy. So, like, there's a real use case for crypto payment rails. It's just way far superior to the existing, you know, ACH or wire.
Oh, networks, I mean, we have like
Swift networks and stuff.
Yeah, we give a discount, 15% discount for Bitcoin or Ethereum.
Oh, nice.
And so, which sounds crazy. We don't ask them to put it in a stable coin.
How do you get that discount?
What's that?
You get a discount?
No, we give the patients a discount if they pay us in Bitcoin.
Oh, you get, yeah.
And we're hodlers, so we just, I don't really care what the price is when they send it. I just want as much as, I can't put as much in of my own money, or the partners couldn't, in Bitcoin or Ethereum, that people could send us, you know, because the payments are 25 to 30,000 a pop. Yeah, it's easier to
receive than to get it in.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd say about 3% of our revenue is Bitcoin and Ethereum. And, you know, it makes...
And that's your stem cell thing.
Yeah. That's a
stem cell. It's funny thing. You say that, because when I got a stem cell treatment and I paid with HBAR.
Oh, really? Oh, that's funny.
Same deal. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I mean, you know, we've got a pretty big operation. We're the largest manufacturer of stem cells in the world.
Wow.
So that's major. We have an operation.
That's awesome.
And, but, you know, I also love Bitcoin and Ethereum. We all do.
Yeah.
There's three partners, Scott, Dedrick, and Francisco, and myself. And, you know, yeah, where people laugh because we'll have big Bitcoin guys or Ethereum guys like, you don't want this in a stable coin first? I'm like, no, you just send it as is.
The risk. Yeah.
We'll give you the 15% discount. We actually dropped it to 10% in February. We're at 15% for the first year and a half. And, you know, it's perfect because you're basically dollar cost averaging throughout the year.
Yeah.
Because people
are
paying at this, you know, random times throughout the month.
That's funny.
And, you know, it's if you believe in
great.
That.
You know, I always say we should have accepted Bitcoin early on for the music. We would have had a ton of that cheap Bitcoin, you know, but it's fine. You know, once we decided to create our own currency and basically mint our own money and create the value behind it, that's when things really started changing for the better.
Yeah.
You know, that's when we started really being able to not always be in a shoestring budget and bootstrap everything, like actually, you know, grow and scale the company and actually build all the things we want to build. Quickly, not take forever.
Are you able to take a loan off of your crypto, or like off of your company?
Yeah, there are crypto lenders. Yeah,
I know there's like crypto lenders. I'm guessing more on an institutional level. Have you?
Yeah. That's something we're exploring.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's been the only problem. Like these ETFs are coming out, and I'm like, you know, I've got a good amount of Bitcoin and Ethereum, and it would be great to be able to. You know,
That's real easy loaning against Bitcoin and Ethereum. There's plenty of providers.
But the interest rates are crazy, like 15% or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's
why. You looked at Nexo at all?
No, what is it?
A Nexo?
No, I have not.
I think they're a crypto lender. You just, you know, you set in your Bitcoin and you borrow against it.
Nice. I'll have to check it out.
There's a lot of providers like that. It's a whole business. There's probably a dozen of them.
Yeah, there's a bunch. I've looked at. I just haven't ever found a place that has
reasonable
interest rates.
Certain loan to value, maybe only loan like 70% against the value.
I would only do 20% actually, just because you have that's fluctuation. Like 20%, and I think that's
up
kind of
to 70%. Yeah.
Well, where the market's going, you know, the entire market though. I mean, you know, Bitcoin's at about $1 trillion. Ethereum's $350 billion, of course, or so. If we have a good bull run this go round, obviously HBAR will go. I mean, I have heard of it. So somebody texted it to me a couple weeks ago, actually, and I kind of got out of the altcoins because I've always done it. If I were just stuck with Bitcoin and Ethereum these years, I wouldn't, you know, I would have a lot more money.
It's like the S&P 500.
Yeah, exactly. But something like HBAR, you figure out those good applications, though. I mean, it does make sense. I'm going to buy some today, so you got HBAR customer.
There you go. Well, you got to buy Jam. That's
where I will. Can get an easy on-ramp, I'll throw some cash at Jam.
Yeah, just download MEXC and...
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah,
but this
exchange
market, though, I mean, you have an opportunity, too, because let's say... What do you think this next bull run? What do you think is going to happen with Bitcoin first of all, in the next 18 months or so?
I mean, it's hard to say. I could see Bitcoin easily going over 100K. I don't see the whole $1 million Bitcoin happening anytime soon.
It's not going to the moon.
Maybe never. Maybe someday. I don't know. But like I said earlier, I think Bitcoin is like super old tech. There'll always be a place for Bitcoin. It's like gold. Gold will always go up. Mm-hmm. Super rare, you know, super slow, high fees, low transactions per second. It's like the oldest tech. Like it's a horse and buggy.
Yeah.
Right. Then you got your Ethereums of the world is sort of like your internal combustion engine, right? Your old cars. And then you've got something like Hedera, which is like Tesla, all the electric cars. So just fundamentally different rails, you know, it just works differently. It's different, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, so I see like, you know, 80% of the actual real world usage being ending up on platforms like Hedera and others, that are of that caliber. There aren't really any that are as good, but sure, there are things that are close enough.
Sure.
But like things like Bitcoin, One, Ethereum will always be around. It's not like they're going to disappear. I just think it'll be less and less relevant over time.
Yeah. See, I mean, my thought is I do look at Bitcoin as digital gold, and the more money that goes into Bitcoin, the better everything else is going to do. Because that's the on-ramp basically.
Yeah,
to
it is an on-ramp
most
to a lot
people
of other.
So
that's
you want it to hit that million because, I mean, just think about that. If Bitcoin were to hit $500,000 or a million, I mean, Hedera would be at probably if the market cap there would be about 10 trillion to 15 trillion in that range, 7.5 trillion. So yeah, I mean, you'd have maybe a $1 trillion market cap for Hedera at that point.
Yeah, Hedera would probably be a few dollars at that point.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's all like percentages, right? Like, you know, Bitcoin's starting at, you know, 50,000, whatever it is. 40,000. So going to a million is the same thing of going from like 4 cents to like $10 or whatever the equivalent percentage is. So, you know, it's great to have this huge number, right?
Yeah.
Like, but then again, that also makes it like less like usable in a way because, like the tokenomics, it's really just, it's a choice that you make to deal with like how easier the numbers to deal with. So it's very hard to deal with if I'm buying a coffee, oh, I'm spending 0.0000134 Bitcoin. Like, what the hell is that? You know, just like the numbers are weird. It feels right to spend like 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 of X coin to buy a cup of coffee, right? And so, and whether it's 0.0000 whatever versus 1 to 10 single-digit numbers – has to do with your total supply, your circulating supply, the tokenomics, the choices you've made, right? How many decimals do you have on the token? Like with dollars, we have 2 decimals. With Bitcoin, we have 8 decimals. Mm-hmm. Ethereum, there's like 11 decimals, you know.
Sure.
We chose 8 for Jam, just, you know, for good measure. We could have gone with less or more or whatever, but at a certain point, it's like, how many decimals are you going to have? And these meme coins, they have, you know, sort of the opposite of Bitcoin, like, where there's 21 million Bitcoin, so the prices are always like tens of thousands of dollars per each unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then with meme coins, there's trillions in supply, so each unit is 0.000001, whatever. So in order to buy a cup of coffee, you need like 10 billion tokens
right.
to buy a cup of... Then you feel like you're in inflation land, like in Africa or something, or I don't know, the Weimar Republic's probably a better one. So that's really just a choice of like, what's a reasonable number to have sure. like easy to deal with numbers?
Yeah.
Where things cost a reasonable amount. So, you know, we chose basically to have around 10 billion Jam. Like, and because, well, the only choice that we really made was 8 decimals. And the way Hedera works, there's a mathematical limit on the whole number of tokens.
Mm-hmm.
So based on the number of decimals, it actually determines your maximum supply. So a lot of people ask, why is your max supply 92 billion, 92 point whatever, whatever? It's literally just a mathematical equation that's built into the Hedera white paper that says if you have X amount of decimals, the whole number of tokens is X. So if we had... say less decimals, then the whole number of tokens, you know, would be more. It would be like 900 billion. Or if we had more decimals, it would be, it's basically wherever you move the decimal place, you're creating this calculation. And it's always the same string of numbers, just moving the decimal place. So with 8 decimals, it turns out to be 92 billion. Okay, great. So even if I wanted to mint more tokens, the 92 billion, I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a hard max supply limit. Whereas most projects, they say, oh, max supply 50 billion. But no, if they decide to wake up the next day and change their mind, they can just hit the mint button and hit another 50 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, maybe the project changes control to some new other entity or whatever, yeah, they can change that.
Sure.
So I just wanted to be super transparent about, like, look, this is an actual hard max supply that's built into the protocol and I can't get out of it whether I want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our total supply, whether it ends up being 5 billion or 10 billion or 15 or 20, you know, to keep it somewhere in that range for reasonableness,
mm-hmm.
you know, it could hypothetically go up to 92, but probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But we really just circulate tokens as the market demands them, you know?
Sure.
So it's like, doesn't matter how many you mint, say a mint of 50 billion, that's just sitting, you know, in the inventory. It's not actually in the market. The tokens that are actually circulating, they have to actually be sold. They have to be bought by somebody. There has to be demand for those tokens somewhere
mm-hmm.
for them to come out of the inventory and be circulated to the market. So whether it's through OTC partners or liquidations on the exchanges. And so that's what actually brings tokens to the market, and that can slow down or speed up depending on the organic demand and institutional demand for the token. But the minting schedule or how often you mint or whether you're minting or not has absolutely no effect on the price. That's just like, you know, basically putting like tokens, storing it in a warehouse. The price has to do with the actual supply and demand of the token in the open marketplace, mm-hmm. you know, what's actually being transacted, what's actually circulating, the circulating supply. So that's the real market cap. So our circulating supply is like basically 3.5 it's actually over like, so we have 4 billion total minted. So it's about 3.5 billion circulating, you know.
How much transactions is done every month right now on it? Like as far as like how much are people putting in?
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly, but I'd say around 500,000 per month.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's moving, you know? It's moving and grooving. It's definitely like we're able to meet our expenses and spend on marketing and all this good stuff and do token buybacks as well. So that's the other thing is, like, if we bring in a huge amount of buys in the token, like institutional buys through OTC, it's over the counter, we could say take half that money, say somebody, you know, wants to buy $1 million worth of jam. And maybe we have to mint more jam in order to even fulfill $1 million worth of jam because we have inventory. Maybe our inventory is like 500,000. Say we mint more jam, but then we can then say take half that million and buy back, do buybacks and buy the jam back. We might mint some, but then we can buy jam and bring in more jam back into the treasury. That's a deflationary thing. Mm-hmm. And then the more the platform gets used, we get 10% of every transaction back to the treasury. So whether it's a micropayment, fraction of a penny, 10% is going to the treasury, or it's a $100,000 NFT sale for some high-level experiences, 10% of that's going back to the treasury. So all that's deflationary pressure on the tokenomics.
Interesting.
So there's always tokens coming back to the treasury and then tokens leaving the treasury. So it's sort of like the U.S. government, right? Yeah. The treasury, right? So you have taxes bringing tokens, dollars back to the treasury. And then you have the treasury and the government spending on programs and sending money back out. And then you have the way money is circulated and with J-PAL and all printing and buying from the treasury and this and that, the Federal Reserve buying from the treasury. Then you have the treasury bonds where people send money. They buy T-bills, right? They're basically sending money to the treasury. It's deflationary. And then those are AAA guaranteed because the treasury can always buy back those bonds with interest because they're the ones printing the money. So there's no way they could default on a currency that they print. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have this concept of T-bills that are the safest asset, gold standard. And so we've actually implemented something similar called JAM Treasury Bonds that we sell as NFTs on the marketplace. So you can buy a treasury bond called a whale bond, sort of like a Liberty bond or something, where you can essentially stake your jam by buying one of these bonds. It's 10% annual yield. So say you have $1 million jam, you buy $1 million jam whale bond. We guarantee that we will buy back 1.1 million in a year from now if mm-hmm. you sell it back to the treasury. Or you can sell it on the open market for whatever it's worth, you know, during that time period. So so that's something cool that we implemented, and that was a great way to bring a lot of jam back to the treasury. It's super deflationary. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like a delayed minting. Like eventually we have to pay back that holder, buy that back with jam. But in the interim, we can bring jam back to the treasury and then sell that again on the open market. Mm-hmm. So this is some of the cool stuff we're doing with. And it's an important discussion about token ops because I do get a lot of questions about it from the community. And everyone, especially like token speculators, they're all about what's the max supply, infinite mm-hmm. supply, this and that. And yeah, the token type is infinite, but there actually is this max supply. Of the 92 billion, mm-hmm. Even though it's technically an infinite supply. But Ethereum is a true infinite supply token. Vitalik can wake up tomorrow and mint like 100 trillion Ethereum.
Yeah.
You know, if he wants to, who knows whether he will, but, you know, maybe somebody drugs him or something. Really yeah. Takes some LSD. I don't know. Maybe he'll just decide to mint a trillion Ethereum. And that could easily happen. Like, there's nothing that's saying that can't happen. Or if somehow somebody else takes control of Ethereum and or Vitalik gets hit by a bus or something, any of these things can happen. You know, I mean, there's a ton of major projects that have infinite supply. And so Bitcoin with the 21 million max supply sort of created this whole low max supply sort of mentality so that you have these crazy big numbers for each token unit. But as you've seen with Dogecoin, you know, it's going from like 0.00010 zeros down to like 4 zeros. You can still make your 10,000x moon shot, and it still hasn't even hit a penny.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, it's neither here nor there. It's apples and oranges.
Sure. You know? Yeah. I mean, I like the max supply, you know, staying at, you know, basically kind of controlling the inflation. But, you know, so the thing with Ethereum, I mean, So he could just go and hit a button one day and there's nothing stopping.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's actually the case with most projects, most Mac Supply projects. Every Mac Supply project, that's a marketing Mac Supply. That's a Mac intended supply. They can wake up the next day and mint whatever the hell they want. So that's why I don't like to say, we're going to Mac Supply 10 billion or Mac Supply 5 billion. I only want to say the true facts, which are, even if I wanted to, I can't mint more than 92 point whatever, whatever. It's just this protocol layer limit. My intention is to maybe have around 10 billion, you know, ideally closer to 5 billion, but definitely less than 20.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no guarantees of what that's going to be because I don't want to put myself in a box and not be able to operate the company.
Sure.
Because in order to bring actual dollars into the company or liquidity into the company, you know, we need the flexibility to be able to circulate tokens and sell to OTC partners. And like I just said, we raised 30 million. You know, where's that coming from? That's on the token. These people are buying the token, right? Well, our whole market cap, our circulating market cap's not 30 million. So, I mean, you know, we haven't brought all that. We're not going to mint, you know, we're not going to like 10x the supply overnight and then just sell it all and pull in the 30 million today. No, we want to build that up over time, build up the price, take in some due buybacks. So buybacks are bringing tokens back to the treasury. So whatever we buy back, we don't have to mint.
How does a buyback work exactly?
It's just like same way with the stock market. Like you know, a lot when the S&P goes up, it's usually because companies are doing a lot of buybacks of stock. They just buy it on the open market.
Yeah.
So they straight up trade. So we just trade. We buy market orders and limit orders like on the open market using our market making partners who are experts at doing this algorithmically. But we just straight up buy the inventory on the open market. We get that jam back in the treasury. We pay real money for it, and the price goes up. So we could we're gonna plan a bunch of huge buybacks. Like we could buy back $1 million worth of jam. That would do wonders for the price. But that's $1 million in hard cash I'm spending on my own token, which I could hypothetically mint at zero cost. But it's very beneficial for not only the price, but enables us to sell at a higher price. And also is good for the tokenomics because then we don't have to mint as much. And then that jam that we just bought back, we can sell at a higher price later anyway and still make money on it. So it's this sort of it's a balancing act, right? You could call it a game that we're playing, but we're trying to balance good tokenomics with good pricing and sort of maximize the amount of revenue we bring into the company, but also sort of like managing the currency in a responsible way. Like Weimar Republic, they minted a trillion Reichsmarks or whatever, and then people were using it for like firewood, you know, back in the early 30s Germany, right? Or these, you know, maybe some African warlords, and they mint like a billion, you know, whenever the currency goes bust, it's always overinflation, right?
Sure, of course.
Of course, you know, we have in the U.S. we have problems with inflation. It causes all kinds of other ancillary problems and effects. You mint too much. But then you have these deflationary kind of situations where you can have, like, Bitcoin's, they call it deflationary, even though it's not. Because whenever the demand for the token is more than the inflation, there's sort of a deflationary sort of behavior to it. And with our token, doing buybacks is technically deflationary. It's pulling circulation out. The 10% fee on everything is deflationary. So the more the platform usage goes up, it's deflationary. So we're trying to balance the deflationary inflationary pressures. And sometimes you have to skew towards inflation. And sometimes you skew back the other direction in deflation. And so we're pulling those levers in both directions. And it's sort of in more of an art form than a science. There's no right way to do it. It really depends on the needs of the business, right? Like if we're locked into a billion per year, which we're going to be coming out of, a billion jam per year is a totally arbitrary number. right? That billion is different today than it is tomorrow. The price goes up or down. The needs of the business are different today than they are tomorrow. We might not need a billion per year. A billion per year might be $1 billion per year worth, or it could be like less than 100,000 worth, depending on the price.
So sure.
Completely arbitrary. The schedule is arbitrary. You have to wait a whole year till the next billion comes out. So say we sell out of the billion. What are we going to do? Have $0 to pay our developers? Have $0 to do marketing? That's an untenable situation. So yeah, we minted a billion in January, and we were doing this billion schedule. But then it became very obvious to us that that's not sustainable at all, mm-hmm. and it doesn't make any actual sense mm-hmm. from an operating business standpoint. So we're going to go to a more dynamic minting protocol. So maybe on a monthly basis, we'll determine how much we need to mint, and we'll mint it. Or maybe we mint nothing. Or maybe we're buying back, and we bought it back so many tokens we don't need to mint anything. Or maybe we need to do a big sale, or we have a certain deal coming through. We have to mint a lot more than the last month. You know, we don't know what that's going to be. We have different costs. We also have, with the whale bonds, the treasury bonds, we have obligations to pay back people who bought these bonds, who are owed their bond amount plus the 10%. So mm-hmm. we have obligations to pay back. Maybe we have to mint to pay back bondholders. Maybe we have to mint to satisfy OTC partners who want to buy the token for dollars. Maybe we buy back a ton of tokens and we build up the treasury and we don't need to mint anything.
Right.
Maybe the platform usage goes through the roof and we have tens of millions of people streaming, and the 10% on all the transactions and all the NFTs is more than enough mm-hmm. to ever mint again. So that's the ideal scenario, where the true utility of the platform, the true usage of the platform, is bringing in enough jam back to the treasury that we can, if we were to sell the exact amount that we're bringing in, then it would be perfectly not deflationary, inflationary. But we might just, I mean, in an ideal scenario, we'll be bringing in more jam to the treasury than we even need to sell. Mm-hmm. So then it would be a pure deflationary token.
Yeah.
So I want to, and it might take inflation to get to the scale of that point, right? Mm-hmm. We might need to inflate the token to bring in the capital to actually spend on the marketing, to get the celebrity artists, to scale to tens of millions of users, to get to a point where it's super deflationary. Mm-hmm. So you'll have inflationary periods and deflationary periods. And ideally, at the end of the day, we have maybe around 10, maybe 15 billion tokens circulating. And then we've hit this scale point where we're actually competing with Spotify. You know, we have the full catalog that's on Spotify and Apple Music and everything. And our experience is better, so we're head-to-head. And we're bringing on tens of millions of users. And then that's a deflationary pressure on the token. So then the price is always going up. So then it's just a great investment. Sure. You know?
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, the tokenomics of a lot of these things, I haven't, you know, really dove into. I know a lot of people do.
Yeah.
And that's their world, and they're looking at it. It's not necessarily my world, but it's good to understand kind of your thought process behind it and how you're going to grow your company, because ultimately you got to have cash to grow.
Yeah. I mean, this is what I think about all day, uh-huh. and I'm kind of lost in it, but this is also everyone who's a token speculator, a lot of these crypto bros,
yeah.
they seem to have very strong opinions about this
yeah.
and, you know, super judgmental. Everyone has their like, oh, it should be this, it should be that. Well, have you ever run a Web3 company? Have you ever issued a token? Do you even know what the hell you're talking about? No.
Yeah.
Like, I know, because I'm actually doing it.
You're
so
living
I know
it.
What we need. I'm living it. Yeah. So I know what it needs to be, what it should be.
You're thinking of tokenomics 24/7, basically.
That's, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, we minted a billion on day one, right, just for starters. And I was very careful. We're never putting a max supply figure publicly. We're not in our white paper, never had max supply. And then at some point later, I clarified, by the way, this is an infinite supply type. That's the technical protocol type. And everybody freaked out. Oh, it's infinite supply. You'll just mint all this stuff. And I'm like, even if I minted a trillion, it doesn't mean anything, because nobody's buying that much. It only matters what people are buying. And then I was like, okay, well, you know, we'll shoot to mint like a billion per year. That seems reasonable, right? And then, and some people like was up in arms about it, like, oh, yeah, 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 it's max supply. And then we're reading the white paper a little bit closer, and we're like, well, actually, there is this protocol level thing called there's a max number of whole tokens based on the number of decimals you have. So we calculated it, and we're like, oh, actually, 92 billion point whatever is the max supply. So even though we're an infinite supply token, yeah, we actually do have a max supply, but this was not a number that I chose. Mm-hmm. This is a number that's like hard limit just in the protocol.
Sure.
And, you know, if we had chose a different number of decimals, we could have had 10 times more or 10 times less. You know, it would have been 9 billion if it was a different, you know, number of decimals. And so I was like, look, so just we're just going to be super transparent. Yeah, everyone's asking us, what's the max supply? What's the max supply? Here's the max supply. It's 92 billion. Mm-hmm. And then we say, well, our intended supply goal is around 10 billion. But we're currently minting a billion per year. But A, that's going to change. And sure, B, 10 billion is not set in stone. And it's going to be whatever it's going to be, whatever it needs to be.
Sure.
And minting doesn't have any effect on price. Like I was saying earlier, it's all about what actually goes into the marketplace, what the demand is for the token, and all that. So, you know, I'm thinking about this all the time. Everyone seems to have their
opinion.
Their opinion about it. People get very opinionated about this. And
yeah, it's more of a, and I understand, like, if people are thinking about investing and they're like, okay, I want to understand how this all works, just like you're talking about Ethereum. Yeah. Hey, they could just hit a button and, you know, infinity. But I mean, so it's reasonable. It's when people get mad and make it personal that it becomes a little uncomfortable for me.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's happening to you. I haven't watched it, but
oh no, it has happened. And that's why I sort of started talking about this. Like,
yeah,
look, we have, I'd say we have the most vibrant, invested community that I've ever seen in crypto.
That's awesome.
Like, we have this thing called the Million Jam Whale Club.
Okay.
That's just an idea I had, like, to incentivize people to buy more jam. I was like, okay, if you buy a million jam, which is like a sizable chunk of jam, you got to put a few thousand dollars down at least. Buy a million jam, you get exclusive access to this private Telegram group. First, we had like 10 guys in there, and they're like, you know, they're our allies, right? They're like super jam whales, you know, call them the whales. And then it started growing, growing. And dude, this group is crazy. There's every time I open it, there's thousands of messages.
Oh shit.
There's like 150 guys and there's thousands of messages. I open every day or two, 2,000 to 3,000 unreads. Wow. I used to read every single message. Now you're I can't even read less than 1%. I just don't have the time. But they've made all their own memes. They have their own stickers. Everything that's jam. Awesome. There's hundreds of jam memes. They're always talking about this and that. And they'll go on Twitter, and if anybody says anything negative, they're FUDDing Jam. They'll attack them. And they're going, everyone who posts anything about crypto, any crypto bro or influencer, they're commenting on all their tweets like, well, what's the next Jam? What's the next 10X, 1000X? Like, yeah. Jam, 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 Jam. Going nuts. And I love it. I love it. It's like great to have those 1,000, or I guess our 100 super fans, right? Our Jam warriors, you know? And so we have our Jam Warriors, or Jam Ambassadors, if you will. And it's super vibrant. So if you're able to get into this exclusive club, all you have to do is buy a million Jam, contact the admin in the main Telegram group where there's like 5,000 people, send a screenshot of your Jam, and she'll invite you in. So you don't have to go through me. You just go through the admin. But yeah, that is where it's at. Like, that is the true epicenter of the nerve center of the Jam community. Is there. And there's some chitter chatter there was a long time ago in the sort of Hedera community groups when people started FUDDing Jam. And the FUD is always the same thing. It's always like, this is an infinite supply token, and they promised a billion max supply, and then they broke their promise to the community and started minting more. Every single thing about that is untrue. Like I've said, it's not infinite supply. There is max supply. B, there was never a max supply to billion. It was always total supply to billion. And C, we've been very clear about what we're minting and when and whatever. And also, that has nothing to do with the price anyway. It's a complete misunderstanding of the nature of tokenomics and crypto markets in general. So we have our guys. Anyone who FUDs, you know, fear, uncertainty,
doubt. The Jambassadors are going after them.
Jambassadors.
That's cool.
We'll send the dogs after you. You know, they're gonna come get you. So, and it's, you know, it's mostly unfair criticism, but I'd say that's a super small minority.
Yeah.
Less than 1% are people saying anything bad. The vast majority of people, you know, speaking out on social media and in the Hedera community groups and all the community groups are always saying positive things about Jam.
Because man, I wish my house wasn't under renovation right now, because we could have like a big Jam party.
Oh yeah, we
should.
Bring
some artist That'd friends awesome. Over. But when it's done, it's going to be about 12 to 14 months of renovation. But maybe next year we could throw a good party. And I actually do a couple parties a year, man.
Oh, so, that's awesome.
Like private ones. I do a circus party every year.
Oh,
4th of July.
I heard about that.
14
yeah,
circus acts this year. It's a lot of fun.
That's amazing.
And then Halloween, we have a giant Halloween party, like costume
that'd be awesome.
Party. I was Willy Wonka last year and had two Oompa Loompas that were with me. But
that's
it's a lot of fun. We have a good time. And but throwing,
we'd love throwing to do a jam party here.
That'd be cool, man. We have a great time. Well, anything else you want to say before we end, as far as, you know, for people want to know about your project?
Yeah. I mean, I know we kind of went on into the weeds about tokenomics and Hedera and all these.
It's okay.
These sort of esoteric
insightful
things,
man.
And, you know, less about maybe the actual project. But what I'd say is, like, look, we're here. I'm an artist. All my friends are musicians. We're the only reason I'm doing this is for the artists.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we want to put the power back in the hands of the artists. We want to help more artists monetize their music. We want artists to be able to earn a living. We want musicians and artists to be able to put food on the table, and not just that, if their song is really great and goes viral, make millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. You know, not just if they have billions of streams, make millions with millions of streams. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's totally possible. And we can make that possible, not just through the streaming royalty micropayments we're paying 100 times more, which is a fair deal. Artists keep 90% of everything, which is also a fair deal. We're giving you, you know, fair deal. But the digital assets, the NFTs, I know the NFT is sort of a dirty word now, like formerly known as music NFTs. It's really just tokenization. If you're not crypto native, it doesn't matter. It's just a limited edition digital item,
mm-hmm.
right? Call it a token, call it a collectible. We call them music collectibles. We've gone through so many names, music collectibles, digital assets, whatever. That's the way to really make big money quickly on the platform. So what we've built in this marketplace is the ability to do a music collectible drop. Think of it like a content drop, where you're dropping a new exclusive song, you know, unreleased song, producer cut of a song, a whole album you can drop with your artwork, with your music video. These NFTs, it's not just a PFP or profile picture JPEG token.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the NFT craze of the past was single JPEG, Bored Apes, nonsense. However you think about that. This is like multimedia, multi-file tokens. And it gets way better than that. That's just for starters. For starters, you can do an NFT drop that's literally a whole album with a music video with, you know, 10 behind-the-scenes photos and, you know, liner notes, everything. In addition to that, you can do unlockable perks. So we have this thing where you can attach to any token perks, basically redeemables, unlockables, whatever you want to call it. We call it unlockable perks. It's an encrypted file or an encrypted piece of information. So you can unlock, say, a backstage pass or a meet and greet with the artist. It's basically token-gated content. So you can have content there, whether it's any form of media that you upload or just text.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a discount code off merchandise at the store. Or maybe you get free merchandise with this code. Or maybe it's the address to a party. Maybe it's somebody's phone number to actually redeem something, or maybe it's the artist's phone number. Maybe it's here's who you need to email. Here's the instructions to get your wristband for backstage, or here's how you can schedule a time. Here's a Calendly link or something to schedule a FaceTime call with the artist, or a Google Meet or Zoom. Or maybe it's here's how you can schedule golf with the artist, or dinner with the artist, or hang out for 2 hours with the artist. You know, these types of super high value experiences that are traditionally not available at all. Like, everyone has their favorite two or three artists, maybe their number one artist of all time. And they just idolize it. They love, they listen a million times. And they'll just do anything to become friends with that person, maybe, if they have the opportunity, maybe to meet them, and they're mm-hmm. starstruck and whatever. And if you have some money to throw around, like, yeah, sure, I'll pay 10 grand to hang out with whoever DJ or whoever band.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And so think of it like the example I sometimes give is, like, what is the highest value experience that I could possibly imagine in the music space that could be sold on our platform, hypothetically? And so what comes to mind is, like, hang out with Jay-Z and Beyonce on a mega yacht in the Mediterranean, like mm-hmm. Mykonos, and for a weekend I'm flown out on a private jet, picked up in Rolls Royce, and then I get to become good friends with Jay-Z and drink Classe Azul with him on the mega yacht, and there's models everywhere. And, like, okay. Now that's like a $1 million experience at least, mm-hmm. you know? For a weekend. And there's plenty of billionaires out there who would totally pay for that. I mean, literally, Jack Dorsey sold a title to Twitter. Jack Dorsey bought Tidal. Twitter bought Jay-Z's platform just so he could hang out with Jay-Z.
Oh, really?
He spent $300 million just to become friends with Jay-Z.
Wow.
And then he was hanging out at the box at the Super Bowl with Jay-Z, mm-hmm. Jack Dorsey and Jay-Z. So, there's an example right there. A billionaire spending $300 million just to become friends with Jay-Z. But there's plenty of other people who are not billionaires, like, say they've got a few million, and they'll spend 10, 20, 50K to have an incredible experience. Say you love Pearl Jam or something, or Metallica, and you want to, like, meet those guys backstage, right?
Absolutely.
Or maybe go to the VIP after party and be at their table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these type of things. We're doing something really cool, I guess. I don't know if I can announce this, but with like Wu-Tang Clan.
Oh, nice.
You know, and so VIP meetup with Wu-Tang. Or, you know, some of these artists, like, we're working with a lot of celebrity A-list artists on figuring out how to create these experiences
mm-hmm.
and then monetize them through tokenization, our platform. So all that's under the unlockable perks. So you can attach even a ticket as an unlockable perk. So say, here's the ticket for the VIP access this after party,
mm-hmm.
right? Or to this special house party. Or here's the meet and greet, the dinner, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or anything. You could attach anything to the unlockable perks. And those can be these NFTs, these tokens with all the content and the unlockables and everything can be sold for a fixed price, or they can be sold for at auction.
Mm-hmm.
So you can allow the market to discover the price. Say you have a bidding war for the Jay-Z hangout, and you have a bunch of people putting 100K, and then 250K, and then 10 people fighting over two spots, right? Or one spot. You have a one of one. It's super exclusive.
And it's paid in Jam.
Everything's paid in Jam.
Yeah.
They have to buy Jam.
Yeah.
So all these bidders have to buy Jam.
Love it.
So say it's bidding at $1 million. You have 10 people fighting over it. That's $10 million worth of Jam that had to be bought just to make those bids. So you can see how that the liquidity can get infused into the market, into the Jam market very easily.
Yep.
And so because with the tokens, you can have that limited edition one of one, true one of one, and it's provable the ownership if you own that token, those unlockable perks are token gated. So the actual, here's the phone number, here's the WhatsApp of Jay-Z's manager who will, you can schedule the logistics for your yacht outing with Jay-Z, right? Like,
sure.
That would be what's in the unlockable perk. Like, if you buy this one of one super exclusive token on auction, you can actually buy, you know, that thing. Or you can have 10 of 10, say for the after party, you can have, you know, no more than 10 people can fit at the table or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
or 100 of 100 for a bigger event, or maybe exclusive access to a Telegram group or WhatsApp group or whatever it is, Discord channel, whatever. You can structure it any way you want. Mm-hmm. So you can create the scarcity or as many tokens as you want. You can put whatever content you can attach to it, music, videos, photos, whatever, artwork, images, whatever. And you can attach these unlockable perks to the token, token-gated unlockable. So we literally encrypt the content, and owning the token decrypts is the key to decrypt it. That's how it actually works. Mm-hmm. Super cool tech. Or you can do tickets. Or because we do the streaming royalty micropayments, you can attach a portion of those streaming royalties, basically the jam that you're earning for people streaming your music, you can attach that revenue, a percentage of that, to the token. So as an NFT collector, I could buy a token that, say 10% of the streaming for that song is tokenized. Mm-hmm. So say it's a one of one, just to make it easier. Let's just say it's 10 of 10. Mm-hmm. Each of those 10 collectors will be earning 1% of the streaming royalties for that on Tune FM. Mm-hmm. So the moment you buy that NFT, that token with the streaming royalties, you're earning instantly alongside the artist. So you can participate in the upside with the artist. So that's a super powerful platform. And there's people who have been trying to build whole companies around that and have not been able to do it. But that's just a feature of mm-hmm. our marketplace, just sure. to show how powerful it is. And then there's also the creator royalty. So the secondary sales royalty. Say if you sell an NFT and then that gets resold again to somebody else on the secondary market, a percentage of that sale goes back to the creator every time. So that's that creator royalty. And that's something that's pretty common on NFT marketplaces. Mm-hmm. So we have the streaming royalty and the creator secondary sale royalty. And so, and the ticketing and the perks and all this stuff. And then you can do multi-tier drops. So each one of those tokens, you could have a gold tier of 1 of 1, silver tier, 10 of 10, bronze tier, 100 of 100. Each one of those are different tokens. Say that is 100 editions, 10 editions, 1 edition. All of that is wrapped up in one big mega drop. So the drop is like the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then you have these tiers with all the different types of tokens. So that's how the marketplace works. And it's super powerful. And that's what's going to enable us to monetize these experiences for artists. It's a whole market that's completely untapped. Mm-hmm. We're talking billions of dollars worth of value to be unlocked. And it's up to the artist to determine what they're willing to offer in terms of access to themselves. But they're definitely willing to offer more than they're selling and putting out there right now.
Sure.
And we know that, and we're willing to place a bet on that. And we're creating the tools to be able to monetize that, to sell those exclusive experiences, limited edition content, limited edition experiences, limited edition anything. Mm-hmm. Limited in any way and priced anyway, whether fixed price or auction. So you can price them $100 a token or $1,000 a token, or put it on auction. Starting bid is 10,000, depending on how high value what you're offering is and how big you are as an artist. And then we enable artists to expand their fan base and market their music and all these things. So we're the only platform that's actually vertically integrated a music NFT marketplace within a music streaming platform. Mm-hmm. So you can actually enjoy the music NFTs where you buy them. Nothing else like this exists. There's things that they say they're music NFTs, or they're just music-related NFTs. We're actual true music NFTs with music attached to it, with all the streaming and everything. And you can stream that song in the music streaming experience where you add it to a playlist, save it to your library, blah, 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 blah. Press shuffle, press play. It's not just a standalone player on a website that plays one song. You know, it's actually a music streaming platform. So I just wanted to like give an overview of like how powerful this platform is and how it's totally different from anything else out there, and how we can actually monetize the music.
Yeah, what artists right now do you have doing those special, you know, performances or packages?
Yeah, so we have a few dozen drops on there right now. There's some rock bands, some EDM DJs. There's one DJ who's has the number one Billboard hits. We're working with a bunch of other DJs. I don't know how much I can say publicly. Usually on like smaller venues, I drop a little bit more alpha on names, but you know what I mean? Like, I don't want to jeopardize anything, but we're talking about tier one A-list DJs, EDM artists who are working with tier one A-list hip hop R&B groups, tier one A-list rock bands and things like that, to do these types of things. We have ongoing discussions with dozens of celebrities at the moment, to figure out what type of NFT drop they want to do, what type of digital asset drop. And part of that is figuring out what's the tokenomics. So what's the right number of limited editions? Mm-hmm. What's the content, like unreleased song or this type of artwork or whatever? And what's the pricing? Mm-hmm. How are we going to do fixed price? How much? Auction? What's the starting bid? How much token? You know, all these types of considerations. So we want to help artists maximize the amount of money that they can raise through their drop. And so we're helping sort of create those campaigns.
That's awesome.
And so we actually do have a really exciting deal going on that we're talking with the Michael Jackson estate to do 44 unreleased songs to be exclusive on TuneFM.
Wow, that'd be huge.
And so one of the first songs we're doing is with Jafar Jackson, who's Michael Jackson's nephew, who's actually playing Michael in the biopic that's going to be released. That's cool. Massive blockbuster. The same director as who did the Bohemian Rhapsody Queen movies, doing the Michael. It's called Michael.
Awesome.
And it's all over Rolling Stone and all this kind of thing right now.
How far along are you on that deal? Is it signed yet, or are you close?
It's very close to being signed. That'd be awesome, so man. By the time this pod probably launches, that's why I'm talking about it. I have mentioned it publicly, but I'm not saying it's signed. But,
sure, you're close.
We're very close. There's a grant component from Hedera Foundation, and there's different.
That's awesome.
Sort of a lot of different stakeholders and moving parts, but everybody's on board. The family's on board.
That's awesome.
The foundation's on board. We're on board. Everyone's on board to do this. We have Jafar, we have all these people, so it's a big thing. And then there's also collaborations with Bruno Mars wants to record a song with Michael. A lot of these songs are unfinished. That's why they're never released. It's like you got a chorus and a verse and like the opening, and like after a minute and a half it kind of like ends, right?
Falls off, yeah.
So it needs to be finished. Mm-hmm. We still have all the stems. We have the original producers, people who produced it with Michael, all that stuff. They're all on board.
That's incredible.
To finish these songs. We need a couple A-list celebrities to do that. So there's been interest from The Weeknd, Bruno Mars, Usher, all these kind of A-list celebrities to do songs with Michael. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be huge. Like, you know, unreleased Michael Jackson. I've heard some of this stuff. It's awesome.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like unreleased, actual net new Michael Jackson coming back from the dead with A-list celebrities recording new verses on it. It's stuff that it'll be a cultural movement. It's going to be a major splash. Like, the only place in the world you can stream this on TuneFM. Oh, and by the way, if you want to pay $10,000 or $100,000, you can hang out with the whole family and tour Neverland Ranch and have front row seats at the show and where they're doing the tour and stuff with the movie and meet Jafar and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's cool.
Starring the movie. You know, we're going to do all types of experiences like that. And there's unreleased Tupac music. There's a lot of unreleased stuff that's sitting dormant, you know. And so that's the stuff I'm most excited about.
Yeah, absolutely.
These types of deals.
Well, I know, like, in Nashville, I had a friend, Chase Lauer. He did Parker McCullough's first NFT.
Who?
And it's a country artist.
Okay, yeah.
But, you know, they did really well. It's like one of the first ones launching out of Nashville. And, of course, we had, you know, the bear market kind of happen, the crypto winter. That recently passed. So NFTs, you know, went down, but there's so much that can be done. And if in the music industry, you're kind of leading that charge with NFTing these special experiences, this access, it really will be a game changer. I mean, you think about like when an artist tours, I've always thought that they leave a lot of money on the table because, you know, they're on the road. First thing that I would be doing if I were a well-known artist is I would be selling access to private show backstage, three songs, you know?
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, private show.
And you think about, exactly. You know, a lot of these artists, let's say they're at least I'm speaking in country music. This is the market that I know better. Let's say they're just got a record deal, you know, they're going on the road. They've got a song in the top 40. Maybe they're getting 10,000 a show, but they got their tour bus. They got their band they got to pay for. So they're not clearing much at all.
They're not making that much money.
You know, at all. And, you know, what would an extra $3,000 to $4,000 to their bottom line do for them on 100 shows? That's $300,000 to $400,000 in a year. So I've always thought that the artist, they haven't, you know, they've left a ton of money on the table that their fans would want access. You know, imagine if you had some guitars sitting at the booth, and you know, you could get a signed guitar and a song from the artist, or three songs for artists. You know, a guy's there trying to impress his girlfriend, and he's like, "Oh, I'll give you $500 for that access." You know, you do that five times at a show, that's $2,500. Selling the strings to their guitars the night before.
Yeah.
You know, selling the hat that they wore. All of those things. They've underutilized the ability to really make money on 100%, the road.
Yeah.
But with the NFT idea, I mean, you could package up a fan club and just crush it. Like the ultimate fan clubs are going, they're going to be, that is the future. NFTs are the future for fan clubs and things like that for artists.
Yeah.
I know you think about this, like you're talking about tokenization all day and all night. You're probably thinking about all these different things within your industry of ways you can monetize. And actually, really what it's about is having the artists make more money. When they realize what you've done, and it's like a, you know, they got to trust you. Yeah. That's probably the biggest hurdle that you're going to face is having the artist trust you, because you get a big name person to put their name behind your company. Obviously the value is going to raise up, but there's a risk because there's a lot of shysters out there per se. Now you've partnered with Hedera and you've got some street cred per se. You're not just like the average company, just starting coming up. You've got some people backing you, but that's going to be in the artist's head. But once it takes, man, everybody's going to want to be doing it because it really is the future of music. And, you know, there's some others out there, but you're kind of the first that's really put it together in a really logical way with some big backers, big companies. Like you had that, you know, we looked at that screen at Google, IBM, all these ones that are backing you. Yeah. So sky's the limit for you, man.
Yeah. I mean, everything you're saying is exactly what we're going after. I mean, the amount of money that's being left on the table, even any given tour, those special access experiences, access to the artist, special experience, the strings, the private show, the whatever it is, the meet and greet, the backstage pass, all these front row seats, VIP packages, dinner, whatever, FaceTime, I'll write a song for you, all the above, whether it's during the tour or outside of the tour, whether it's a digital experience or real life experience, those are all high utility experiences that we're tokenizing.
Yeah.
Because there's no real marketplace for that stuff.
Well, just think about this too. The early artists that are in with you, you know, they're getting paid back in jam, right? They would have to offload the money. 50% put in cash, the other 50% keep in the coin.
Exactly.
5 years, you know, you could 20, 50, 100 extra money if all goes well. So you have the potential upside too. That they might not realize.
Yeah, I mean, there's anyone who wants to take the risk on the token price can feel free to keep their jam.
Yeah.
That's the easy way to go. They earn jam. Either they can offload it, say they need to pay their expenses, whatever, pay for food, whatever. But the rest they keep in jam as an investment, as a speculative thing.
And
if that 100X is, because all these dynamics we talked about, whether it's deflationary or the bidding war stuff or the fact that everyone else is not offloading all their jam. You know, all of these things feed into the fact, also just bringing in new fans and new demand and people actually buying jam with a credit card to spend on music, people buying jam on a credit card or on exchange to buy a high-value NFT.
Sure.
You know, it's all bringing new liquidity into the market.
Yep.
And with the buybacks, with all the stuff, the deflationary pressure of the 10%, all this is, you know, creating a really nice picture for where jam can go into the future from a price action standpoint.
Yep.
Obviously, do your own research and not financial advice and all yada yada. And I don't know what price it's going to end up being. Yeah. Who knows? God knows. The sky's the limit. Jam $1, jam $10, jam $1 million. I don't know. Or jam zero. You know, it's like, who's to say, right? Yep. It is what it is. You know,
there's just that potential for the upside for the artists. I guess there's a potential for it to be less too.
Yeah.
So you know, that's part of the that's part of the risk. My thought though is, especially the ones that would get in now or in the next more, 12 months, there's more of a potential
more upside,
for
it's sort of like joining YouTube in the really early days. Yeah. Like if you go viral on YouTube, you just own YouTube, you know, like Mr. Beast or whatever. But the thing is like the trust factor is a hurdle. So you get rewarded by being an early adopter and
you know, have helping build jam, that trust. The jam millionaires, they joke about it years from now. Like, we just bought, or you know, we were an artist, we got $10,000 and we kept it in and now it's a million.
You're gonna hear all like these stories.
Didn't know that I had it in my hard drive.
Yeah. But and our jam whales will all be millionaires if jam hits a dollar, you know, fingers crossed. But yeah, it's really about those use cases. Like when we show, and we are working on this, of like showing a video start to finish of this artist creates their NFT drop, they upload their music, they push it to their, say they have a million followers on Instagram or TikTok or whatever.
Yeah.
They push it out there. All of a sudden they're earning thousands of dollars from streaming that they never saw from Spotify. They bring all their fans over to TuneFM. They do a big drop. They're super fans. Start spending money. They make a few $100K in a few hours with their drop. And they're like, holy crap, I've never made this much money in my life. I can hardly pay my rent. And I have millions of fans, you know?
Why don't you have
those kind of
Why don't you do
cases?
Like a jam coin tour and, you know, have all the payments for the artist, you know, strike a deal with the right artist and have all the payments from the fans, et cetera, be, or most of them, you know, all that can be in jam. Token. Is it jam token or jam coin?
Yeah, jam token, jam coin, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Technically jam token, but whatever. I mean, I'm open for anything. I mean, we want to have there's so many ideas that we haven't even done, like jam tour, jam tour bus, you know, jam festival, jam fest, the jam fest in the metaverse. We're actually building a whole music festival in the metaverse with tokenized tickets,
that's
NFT ticketing,
shit,
and
I don't know if I'll ever get into that shit, but yeah,
it's basically just
I get it.
Yeah. It's just VR, right?
I get it.
You're gonna put your Apple Vision Pro on, go to a show in the metaverse, go to a DJ rave party, see your favorite DJ perform live, go to the main stage, see a big band play, and maybe it's cool. A real live show that
you're
watching.
I've never even been in the metaverse. I haven't done the whole VR thing. I like live concerts.
Once you do VR, it's you can see why it's getting popular.
I see.
But then you can make friends. You can go with your friends. Say you have friends all around the world. You all go to the show together, your favorite artists. You have your favorite band. You go see them. There's maybe an acoustic stage. You know, there's maybe a rave den or some like a psychedelic forest DJ thing. And it's all super cool, and maybe there's art everywhere, and maybe there's like a country music bar, there's a karaoke bar.
Sure.
You can create whatever world you want in the metaverse. So we want to create this like amazing, super trippy, like music festival experience, like a Coachella, Lollapalooza, but in the metaverse.
Yeah.
Sit on your couch and anytime you want, go have that festival experience.
Yep.
Catch a couple shows. You'll see the lineup. Every day there'll be a lineup. It's a festival that never ends. You know, so that's an idea. We also want to do real world festivals.
Yeah.
You know, we want to do the Jam Fest, you know, professionally done, like the whole bit.
Sure.
And like book all the best artists, sell all the tickets through Jam, use our platform for all the ticketing and everything, the whole bit. All that's coming, you know. It's all in due time. Once we get a couple A-list celebrity artist drops out there and the use cases behind them showing behind the scenes of how much they were able to earn and we're able to demonstrate some case studies to other artists like, hey, this artist you might have heard of was able to generate $2.3 million on this drop just doing this, this, and that.
Sure.
Like, holy crap, well, we can do something like that. And then they do it, and then they do it. And then it's a snowball effect.
Yep.
So, you know, we've just sort of quietly rolled out this marketplace recently, right? We've been building it for over 2 years. Like, it's super robust. Nothing else like it exists. Nothing else is even close to existing with this level of functionality, this level of utility. So now we're ready to go to market. And we've lined up an incredible roster of artists and celebrities and these really cool opportunities like Michael Jackson, Legacy Catalogs as well, to really go-to-market come out there with it. So, I mean, this is like the calm before the storm. Yeah. We're right before the hockey stick inflection point. I mean, you saw the chart. Like, it's just begun. And that's just because we announced the $20 million funding. Now it's $30 million. Mm-hmm. And there's more coming, you know? And so it's a really exciting time to get involved. You know, you're in early. You have that feeling of, like, being the right place at the right time. And that's where we are right now. You know, things are only going up from here.
Jam to the moon.
Jam to the moon. Jam moon, as our jammer wells say.
Awesome, man. Well, it was great talking to you, man. We've been going 2 hours now, so that's...
Yeah, that's good.
It's a good little wrap. So, yeah, thanks for coming by.
Appreciate it.
Anytime you're in Nashville, stop by. And,
love it.
I want to get some updates here as this thing's blowing up, man.
Some alpha. All right. Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, man.
Nice to meet you.